The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition today, where we're going to do our best to answer your questions, mostly to have come in via email or through the contact form on our website. Best way to get a hold of us to submit your own question would be to go to that website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can send in your question. If it's, direct to the point, on one topic and not a rambling, multi-faceted type of question, it will increase your chances of getting it answered more quickly than not on the show. We don't answer every single question. A lot of questions we get are very specific to a person. They'll have all kinds of details. It'll be 18 different facts about them, and it's just too much to really turn into a podcast Q&A kind of a situation. But a lot of times it's just people kind of clarifying how something works, the rule for something, the tax implications for something, those sorts of things. So if it's a on one topic, that does increase your chances of getting it answered pretty quickly. I know Jim's been rummaging through the pile of questions that we've got today, and he's going to reveal to me and you simultaneously what those topics might be. Is that the pile?
I was going to tell you the bad news. It's not only this pile. It is this, all of these, and these. It was all the ones we found in that junk folder that was being automatically moved in.
It was accidentally directing them to the junk folder. That's not good news.
No, we have over 100 emails, so we either have to faster, answer more briefly, which is going to be hard for you, or get rid of a lot of the older ones. And I mean, we can't answer. It's like if you call up Dave Ramsey or who's that other guy, Eidelman. Mm-hmm. I'm sure not every single caller gets on the show. Single emailer
isn't going to make it anymore.
No.
And that's why I said the more direct, to the point, singular topic type emails, when you're rustling through that pile there.
It's huge.
Yeah, I know. But you're going to, I notice you pluck those out. Here's a good question.
Yeah,
you know,
I do. I'm starting see, now. So. Years ago when we did this, it was if an email question came in, we answered it. Yeah. And then we went on to talking because we weren't getting a lot of email questions. Now we do, which is great. And that's why we have a dedicated Q&A show. But what had happened, listeners, is who do we use? Smarsh or something like that? I don't know. We have an email provider. I think it's called Smarsh. And it's because the SEC mandates all our emails be traceable and trackable for like 5 years or whatever. So this company does all that. And there's a few companies out there who work with financial advisors and make sure all their emails are being retained. It's called retention rules. Anyways, I have my computer set up that Chris has it all downloaded to Outlook. And that's fine. But the other day, for some reason, Laura logged directly into Smarsh. And we looked in the junk folder out of, I don't know why, we just did, or clicked it somehow. She was doing something. And it was just full. Well, none of those ever made it into Outlook.
Right.
And it just was, oh my Lord, what are all these? And it was emails coming in. If the email was direct, if you typed in jim at jimhelps.com into your email and sent it to us, that for the most part, but it wasn't all, some of those were being flagged. For some reason, Smosh was thinking they were junk, but it was the forms. If people were filling in the form on the website with their question.
Where I keep sending them to go.
Exactly. So we got it set up now, and I've checked, and it's not flagging them anymore as junk. We set it up to tell Smarsh that that's an okay, even though it's coming from a form, it's not junk.
Okay.
And
so problem fixed moving forward. So
problem fixed.
If you sent in an email question a long time ago, and you thought, well, I followed Chris's instructions, it was direct, it was to the point, it was easy to answer, but I still haven't heard anything. Maybe that happened.
Now you know why.
So we're probably going to have to just draw a line in the sand and say everything older than maybe December or November is just in the past. And
we still have this folder from 2017.
No, we're not going there. I think anybody who's still listening who wants their question answered needs to just send it in again, maybe. I think that might be the way to do it.
But if you remember, listeners, Laura cleaned my side of the recording studio desk once when I was gone. She pulled a trick that my mom used to do when I left somewhere and I'd come home, my bedroom was cleaned, and it used to tick me off because
I didn't know where anything was
after she cleaned it. Anyways, Laura thought she would be nice. What was it, last year she did this? And she cleaned the recording studio and threw away a lot of stuff, which I guess in hindsight we didn't really need. But she put all emails in this cute little blue folder, put it nicely on the desk, never really told us that that nice little blue folder was emails, and we didn't find it until last year, a whole year later, that she had done that. So,
well, let's start whittling away at the pile and
see where we go.
Knock out what we can today.
All right. This one is a Social Security question, and it's from a Coloradoan. He emailed us 4 months ago, so hopefully he didn't need an answer too quickly. But it begins, and I'm going to read it because it does apply, and it talks about WEP. So he references Colorado's PARA system, but listeners, this can apply to anyone who may be in a government pension. So he begins, my wife has 10 years of substantial Social Security earnings. She will also have 20 years into the Colorado PARA system in 2021. She can start collecting Social Security in 2020 when she turns 62. If she does, she will receive $575. She could then, the following year, turn on her PARA for $1,800. I know the WEP chart, windfall elimination provision, for those of you who don't know what he meant by WEP, I know the windfall elimination provision chart says it will reduce her Social Security by at least $470. That's probably changed by now, because he wrote this last year.
That's the 2019 numbers, basically, he's quoting there. But he's wrong there, but go on.
Okay, I'm just reading what he says.
Yep.
You can straighten it out.
Yep.
I know the WEP chart says it will reduce Social Security by at least $470, but the WEP rules also state if your Social Security benefits are low, you will be somewhat protected by their promise not to reduce your benefits by more than half of the pension you are receiving from your non-Social Security job. So with all this in mind, are they saying my wife's Social Security will be reduced by $900 or will it be reduced by $470?
I have excellent news for them. Even less than that.
Well, why don't you explain a little? Because he's talking from someone who kind of knows what all this is about, but a lot of our listeners are going to be out there in left field. And this really applies to people who have a government job and don't pay into Social Security and will receive a government pension or a government-sponsored defined contribution plan instead.
Yes. So there, in this case, his wife is affected by WEP because she has a non-covered pension, in this case, Colorado Para, but this happens a lot of places around the country. And the rules are, what it does is it essentially changes the equation for calculating your benefit. Not to bore you with too many details, but essentially the first, you know, 950 or so of your Social Security, or I'm sorry, of your average indexed monthly earnings is replaced in your Social Security benefit at 50%. Okay, so the reason for that, the reason that he is concerned about this is that can be cut that first tier, we call it. It's really up to the first bend point, say, and I'm just rounding numbers here, so let's say that first bend point is at 950. That would mean they would reduce your benefits by $475 if your average index monthly earnings were higher than that $950 amount. The good news is it doesn't reduce it a flat dollar amount, that full $470 or $75 that he and I are referencing here. It really affects it, the calculation, by reducing it by half of however much earnings you have underneath that $950. Now, in this case, that $575 figure, they're assuming that you don't have WEP in those calculations. On your Social Security statement, they don't know about your non-covered pensions. All they do is they put a footnote on there saying you might have a reduction because of WEP. They don't tell you what it's going to be. So in this particular case, through the magic of math, I can tell you that her average indexed monthly earnings turned out to be about $639. How do I know that? Because without WEP in the equation, that first 950, which of course 930 or 639 is less than that, is replaced at 90% normally. So that 639 becomes that 575 benefit that he was referencing. The good news is there the reduction factor, if you will, is one half of this amount. So his reduction is only going to be, doing a little math here, about $319 per month. So there is protection against low benefits being wiped out by WEP. It's not a dollar amount. WEP is not a dollar amount. It has a cap. That $470 figure is the maximum it can be, but it can be lower than that for two reasons. It can be lower because your Social Security benefit is low enough that the reduction is based on a percentage of that small Social Security benefit. That's the case in his circumstances. Or if the non-covered pension is small enough, in this case it was $1,800 a month, so there's no protection there. But if that non-covered pension was, say, $200 a month, they're going to limit your WEP reduction to one half of that amount, or $100. Now, that doesn't apply here because the benefit of $1,800, half of that is $900, and the WEP is already capped at well below that. But in this case, I suspect they're going to see a reduction of only about $319 rather than the offset of the full $470 or whatever. So better than what he was expecting. His two choices were both higher than what the actual offset will be. So she'll collect a small amount. Just so you know, it's not the case in this circumstance, but if you had more than 20 years of what are called substantial earnings in the Social Security system, even with a non-covered pension, the WEP offset can be reduced or ultimately eliminated completely if you've got 30 years of substantial participation in Social Security. That doesn't apply in this case, so I'm not going to go into the details there, but just know if you, just because you have a non-covered pension doesn't guarantee you're going to have a WEP offset. You might escape for a variety of reasons. One, having enough participation in Social Security through other jobs. Could be that the benefits that you're receiving are so low that you're protected to have almost no WEP. So there's a few factors here. But in this case, she obviously, with 10 years, hasn't come even close to the 20 years of Social Security participation she would need. But she is going to be protected because her Social Security benefit is low enough that she's not going to have the full WEP offset, the maximum WEP offset of the 470, roughly. And these are rounded numbers. They're not as precise.
Perfect.
Those of you nitpicking.
Okay? All right. Well, we beat that horse to death, so let's go on to more. We've got, this is an old question, and it ties into a new question, so I'm going to kill two questions.
Nice.
Both have to do with our fun number approach. Apparently, we were talking about fun number to our listeners for a while, Chris, because this one is one of the recently found ones from August of last year. So we're right
That's
on top
about
of
when
this
we started one. Talking about it, yeah.
We're right on top of this email, so I apologize to this listener. But we're going to call her, it's a female, we're going to call her Georgette to protect her anonymity. But she begins, "Dear Jim and Chris, I love your approach to determining a fun money bucket." She calls it a bucket. It's really, I think she's mixing our concept of a fun number with our spending concept of bucketing. But she says, "I love your approach to determining a fun money bucket, but I wonder, how often do you have to work on finding a way to generate the large sums of money that could be spent early in retirement but might not be readily available? It may be available in a future calculation over time, but perhaps not all at once. Maybe you have to wait for the pension income to turn on, or Social Security to be claimed, or for an inheritance to be received. Say you could pull all the money out of a qualified retirement account, but that would cause you to jump into a higher tax bracket and then lose even more money to taxes. I guess it seems likely that there's actually added complexity to your fund number spending, especially with more upfront than it sounds when we simply sit here envisioning this big bucket of money full of cash just waiting to be spent on fun things. Mm-hmm. How do you see this all being worked out? Thanks for your inspiration." And she signs it her real name, but we're going to call her Georgette. Mm-hmm. Interesting number. Mm-hmm. I can see her working on all this, and I know you're chomping at the bit. Before you get into it, I just want to point out a few things. The concept of a fun number or a fun number bucket that you're talking about is something we believe passionately in, listener, or all listeners. And we believe in helping people come up with that and then encouraging them to spend it. I'm not going to get into, and neither is Chris, what that fun number is. She's asking, how do we get the money? We've got all this money, but it's in all these different areas. Some is an inheritance that's coming later. Some is going to be a pension, but I'm not turning it on yet. Some is Social Security, but I'm delaying to age 70. A lot of it is in an IRA, and if I take it out too fast, I'm going to be hit with taxes. Welcome to retirement. It is not simple anymore, because she hit the nail on the head, Chris. There are all these different pools of money, all being pulled in different areas. Now, one thing I will say, any money tied to secure income, pension, Social Security, and income annuity, in our measure, isn't going to fund your fun spending. It should be going to fund your minimum dignity floor. Only if there's any extra money. you have enough pension, Social Security, and income annuity that it covers your minimum dignity floor, which again, in our practice, is your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care expenses. Only if there's extra money beyond that, would you agree, Chris, we would apply that to the fund number.
Yeah, some people have what we refer to as excess secure income.
We call them
unicorns. In our world, excess just means more than covering the minimum dignity floor. It doesn't necessarily mean you have more than you want to spend on everything. That would be a normal person's definition of excess. In our world, it's just referring to having excess above the minimum dignity floor. And some people, especially couples that both have a really strong pension, fall into that category. And that by default, they're going to have that extra money coming in and have it available for spending on fun stuff.
So I'm assuming as you wrote this email, listener, you were factoring that in. You wouldn't direct your Social Security to fund. You wouldn't direct your pension to fund and subject your minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care to the variability withdrawals of the market. We prefer to match the income to the minimum dignity floor expenses and match your fund spending with withdrawals from your assets. So let's get to the next part. You're wondering, where does this big pool of money come from? You've got all these different things going on. Well, the first thing, simplify it. Chill out. Simplify it. Just look at your assets through three pools. Accounts whose money being withdrawn will always be subject to taxes. Those would be the qualified retirement accounts you allude to. And for those who don't know what this listener meant by the word qualified, that's an industry term that pretty much references any type of account whose earnings, quote unquote, qualify for special tax treatment. Usually, these type of accounts will always be subject to taxes. IRAs, 401ks, TSPs, 457s, 403bs. We call them always taxable accounts. Then you have maybe taxable accounts. Withdrawals from these accounts may be subject to taxes. They may not. They tend to be subject to capital gain taxes. They tend to be eligible for capital gain deductions. So they may be subject to taxes, may not. Loss deductions. These are often bank and brokerage accounts. Then you have what we call never taxable accounts. These are generally Roth-style accounts that have been open for at least 5 years and you're over the age of 59 and a half. We won't get into all the Roth withdrawal rules on getting the money out tax-free, but let's just assume you satisfied those rules. And to a far lesser extent, borrowing from cash value in life insurance, something that I'm not a fan of, but if you do have policies with a lot of cash value, you could borrow that tax-free. So those are the three style accounts. I'm going to let Chris talk about a strategy that we call tax-optimized spending. In other words, don't think for a minute our retirement plan that we could do or a retirement plan you hire someone else to do or for you do-it-yourselfers, an Excel spreadsheet that you might have painstakingly written for years and optimized and improved. Don't think any of those three processes of projecting your retirement are ever going to tell you exactly what accounts you should spend from every single year. It's impossible. You instead have to analyze it every November or December. That would be almost in arrears, right? You wait till the year is over and then you figure it all out.
Right.
Well, what we mean by simplify it, try to have the first year's spending of retirement on fun. Your minimum dignity floor stuff should be covered with Social Security, pension, income annuity, and any money that you've reserved. We talk about this in a series of EDU shows that just came out, 5-part series on all this. Let's just assume the minimum dignity floor is taken care of, Chris. It is a woman. I did say that because her name's Georgette.
Yeah.
She's only talking her fun.
Right.
So try to have, listeners, your first year's fun spending all in cash, all in a bank, all after tax, already free and clear money. In a perfect world, your first year of retirement will have that. Preferably a little bit more than just that.
Yeah.
But if you had all of that, then all's what you need to do is what?
Now you're going to spend initially from that money. Don't overthink it at the beginning of the year trying to guess what's the best accounts to be drawing this stuff from throughout the year as you're spending, covering your expenses. Then later in the year, when you get into this November time frame, and it'll become clear why we're waiting to the end of the year to do this, it's mainly because a lot of the decisions you have to make to strategize for tax purposes have to be enacted by the end of the year. So you need to figure things out once you get close to the end of year at November time. So let's say you've been spending from cash throughout the year. You haven't generated any distributions from taxable accounts or recognized any gains through your selling to fund expenses or anything like that. It's all been coming from this cash. But then in November, now you can look back on that year. You can look back on that year and figure out, first of all, did you have any forced income or gain recognition? This can come in the form of interest and dividends that's been paid out to you in these maybe taxable accounts, distributions that were forced upon you, maybe required minimum distributions. There could be churning or sales that have happened in some kind of managed account that you didn't necessarily direct yourself, make that decision, but they just kind of happened. And you've got to figure out essentially what income before you make another step forward is going to end up being reported on your tax return.
And don't forget, before Chris goes on, you still have, even though we're not considering it in this context of this answer, don't forget behind the scene, you got your minimum dignity floor being covered with Social Security, pension, and income annuity. So that income is coming in.
Unless they're in the delay period.
Unless you're in the delay period, and it's being directed for that. So what we tell our clients, and don't overcomplicate your retirement. So many people were coming to us in January, clients of ours. Hey, I did a retirement plan for you 3 years ago. How much should I spend? It's January. I just retired. What accounts do I take it out of? We can't tell you, we were telling them. Instead, just spend from a bank and don't worry about it. Spend from a bank and in a perfect world. And if you are in the delay period on your minimum dignity floor, hopefully that money is in the bank as well. Your first year spending should hopefully be in the bank. Then Chris came up with this idea a few years ago, and he was starting to counsel with clients that, hey, wait a minute. Just spend from your bank money and don't worry about this. When we started bringing taxes in-house, we started realizing a few years ago, if we could just have clients spend cash in a bank in year one, in November or December, we will have 10 or 11 months of their income already known. And when we say spend cash, it's net of any secure income that's coming in. We're not saying just take your Social Security, pension, and income annuity and don't spend it, put it off to the side. No, you're going to spend that. But any money that needs to make up the difference on your minimum dignity floor and your fund in year one comes out of cash.
Right.
So what Chris is getting at is at the end of year one, November, December, you have essentially no tax liability from your spending because it came from cash, but you may have a tax liability from Social Security income, pension income, annuity income, interest, dividends, capital gain distributions, rebalancing
rent income, throw in this whole bag, anything that might have happened,
royalties,
it's going to be a taxable
all
event.
Of these things, we have 11 of the 12 months of income known for that year.
And the challenge and the way people wish it happened is we would know what was going to come in the year ahead. We would somehow in January be able to divine exactly what was going to happen. And they'll say, well, I know how much Social Security I'm going to get. I know this, that, and the other thing. And I would ask them, well, do you know exactly how much interest you're going to get? Do you know exactly how much dividends you're going to get? Do you know exactly how much this managed fund of some kind is going to generate in cap gains? Are you sure rent is going to turn out the way it really was? And, of course, they had to admit, I don't know those for sure.
And we'll concede. Some people have all of their money in IRAs.
Right, have a very simple situation.
And it's not, because she's talking about having money in all these different places. Mm-hmm. If you have a simpler situation where all your money is in qualified IRAs and there's no Roths, there's no maybe, it's just all in these accounts. If that's the case, you've got a much easier situation, and you may not need the first year spending in cash. It's just, it is what it is.
Well, there's reasons you might want to have it in cash or cash-like items beyond taxes. We're talking about the tax implications
right.
here.
I'm trying to answer her question on taxes and how to position all these different amounts. What I want you to do in a perfect world is have the first year spending in cash, and then it's kind of automatic for you every year. What you do in that first year is you get through that first period of retirement. Then you do a preliminary tax return, the end of November, beginning of December. You will have most of your income known by then. Now you look, and you're going to look at two things, actually probably three things. But you're going to want to look at your tax situation for that year. You only have to estimate now December, folks. It's the only month left that you have to estimate. December. How hard is that? Well, if you have a lot of maybe taxable assets, especially actively managed mutual funds, it could be a lot harder than you think because you never know what the funds are going to generate. Or if you have consulting income or other types of income, everyone has all these different types, I can't think right now, but you should be able to get most of your preliminary taxes done in December, beginning of December. And then you're going to look at first, what do you need to do to optimize your taxes for that year? Remember, you haven't taken any distributions out. Maybe you're barely filling the 12% bracket and there's tons of room in that 12 bracket left. Now you can start taking some withdrawals, Chris, from your IRAs perhaps. Start taking some money out of the IRAs to fill those lower brackets. The other thing you need to be looking at is a tax projection analysis. Now we said in our series of EDU shows, where I believe it was show number 4 or 5, where we got into tax projection, we freely told you do-it-yourselfers, here is where you are going to have a hard time. Finding the ability to project what your future taxes are going to be. There are so many moving parts to it that we use very sophisticated software. But if you're a do-it-yourselfer, maybe you have a program you purchased. I don't know if there's one that exists, but maybe you have one. Maybe you wrote an Excel spreadsheet, or maybe you just hired someone to do this part of the analysis for you. But you need to now be looking at where your future taxes might be if you did nothing to optimize them. In other words, where are your taxes going to be after required minimum distributions begin at age 72 now, and after Social Security is turned on after age 70? What are your taxes going to look like? So now you have an idea, should you keep filling your tax bracket this year? Should you fill more than just the 12 bracket? If you just happen to be in the 12 bracket, should I fill more than the 12? Well, gee, this projection is showing that I'm going to be in the 32 bracket. I've got $3 million in an IRA. This is going to send some serious required minimum distributions my way. And my wife has a wonderful government pension, perhaps. So now you might start making a decision in December. I'm going to optimize my 12% bracket. I'm going to look at next year's spending, figure out what I want to do for next year, and maybe take that money out of my IRA. But now you're going to be faced, Chris, with maybe converting some. That's mm-hmm. where I'm trying to go with this. Mm-hmm. That if my bracket is going to be way into the 30s and taking care of it, optimizing this year's bracket and satisfying my spending for next year, maybe there's still room you can do Roth conversions, or maybe not. Maybe Roth conversions are off the table. What we're trying to get you to understand is there is no software program that we know of that can project in 2020 exactly how you're going to spend in 2021, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and all the way forward. You have to look at it every year. And you have to look at it through the prism of three things. What is going to optimize my tax bracket this year? In other words, in your first year spending, if you did it all right, the only money you got was Social Security, pension, income, annuity, if you turned any of those on, as well as Chris called it, forced distributions from interest, dividends, things like that, consulting income, royalties, rent. You haven't voluntarily taken a distribution out of anything but a bank account right now. So your spending has not impacted your taxes. That's what we're getting at in that first year. The end of the first year, you're going to look at the bracket that you're currently in. Because remember, you haven't spent anything yet from a taxable source. You've just spent bank money. Everything else was forced upon you. Let's just say that got you halfway into the 12. I think you would agree, Chris, Trump tax cuts, the 12 is going to 15, you're only halfway in, you might as well take out enough from your IRA to fill that 12.
Right, either take out or convert, depending on if you need it out right. or converted. I mean, those are the two ways that you can recognize some of that deferred income, because that's essentially what these are. You've delayed recognition of this income in these tax deferred accounts. As the money comes out, it gets recognized as income. You're going to make the conscious choice of how much you want to recognize as income. And that recognition happens on either a distribution or a conversion. That's what's going to end up on your tax return as taxable income. And by doing it at the end of year, you've got the most clarity on your situation. And you can make the best choice at that point. And then when you roll into the next year, essentially you end up doing it over again.
And that's the second thing. I didn't mean right. to interrupt you, but the second thing you're going to look at is next year. What do I need for spending next year? What do I want to do? How much more do I need to cover my minimum dignity floor shortage? How much fund spending do I think I might want to do? And why do we want you to do that? Well, we also want to try to project what next year's taxable income might look like. Because maybe it would make sense to take out some of next year's spending, Chris, on this year's taxes. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we're looking for there. And if you are like a lot of people and you have just enough money in a bank account to get you through 1 or 2 years of spending, we got to replenish that. So at the end of the year, we want to know, what are we going to need next year? And would it make sense to fill more than this year's tax bracket? So many people, Chris, just fixate on filling this year's bracket. They don't look at where they're going to be next year. So what we need to do is look at that. And then the third thing you need to look at, honestly, is what your future taxable income may be once required minimum distributions begin and all sources of income are turned on. Social Security, pension, and income annuity is on. Most of that happens by age 70. And required minimum distributions are turned on for those of you who are under the new Secure Act at age 72, for those who weren't grandfathered at 70 and a half. So that future projection also needs to be looked at. And then you can decide, how much money do I want to take from an IRA or a 401k? How much money do I want to take as a capital gain or a capital loss from my maybe taxable account? And how much do I want to take from my Roth? Don't hesitate to take from a Roth. Everybody thinks, oh, I got to wait till the very, 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 very end on the Roth. Not necessarily. And it may mean that some money needs to be locked in 100% tax-free with a Roth distribution. Everyone is different. But we call it a tax-optimized spending analysis. You do have all this money, but you really have all this money in three different style accounts, always, maybe, and never. And all's what you need to do every December is figure out how to optimize the bracket you're in, how to plan for next year's spending. Do you have enough cash or do we have to replenish it? And then look at future tax issues and decide, my spending is done, guys, but my God, I'm going to be hit with some massive taxes when RMDs start. Or as a widow or a widower, we're going to be pushed into a very high bracket and we want to spend more in taxes today. We talk about that a lot. I know it sounds complicated and it's a concept that's hard for Chris and I to explain to people, but it works once you do it a few times.
And the only way
you see it.
Yeah, the only way you can pull this off, obviously, with all these moving parts, being able to choose to move them, is if you create for yourself some tax diversification. If you enter retirement and every dime is in always taxable, we don't need to do a whole lot of adjusting or doing anything beyond. You might think, oh, my, there's no question I'm going to take it all out of there. Clearly, you're going to distribute from there to live on because that's the only source you have in my simplistic example. But at the end of the year, you're still going to want to look at it at least basically because you might want to do some additional distributions or conversions above and beyond what was forced out due to your spending. So even if you have no diversification and it's just in one type of this account, there might still be total justification for looking at these optimized tax approaches, if you
especially
will.
Especially if you have bucket list items and you're going to go, and we have a client going on a $75,000 around the world cruise. Now, in a perfect world, let's just say in a perfect world, they would have tax diversification. Let's say they were in a non-perfect world. And we have many people we've ran into with 80, 85, 90% of their money and always taxable. Well, if you know in a few years, in addition to your regular fund spending, you're going on that $75,000 around the world cruise and all your money is in always taxable accounts, why on God's good earth are you going to take that out all at once in the year you're going to do it?
Right.
You need to be looking every year in December. And that's what I said. You're looking at three things. Optimize the bracket you're currently in. That's a no-brainer. Look at next year's spending, and in all honesty, the next couple of years' fund spending. And look at where your taxes are going to be when required minimum distributions and all sources of secure income are on, which is pretty much between age 70 and 73. Those are the three periods you're looking at, and you're going to optimize each year's distributions. What am I taking from my Roth? What, if anything, what am I taking from maybe taxable, if anything? What am I taking from always taxable, if anything? These are the three things we have to look at, and it all comes down to spending, because you hit the nail on the head, listener. You're salivating over this nice big pool of fun money that if you follow our process, you are going to have the clarity, confidence, and comfort to spend it. The plan gave you the clarity. You got the confidence. You crunched the numbers. You're going to feel comfortable spending this money because all the other items are covered. We won't get into that. Listen to our EDU shows. But you're worried or wondering, how do I pull it all together? Mm-hmm. Don't overanalyze it, but don't lose sight of taxes. Taxes are everything now. And that's why we often say we are retirement planners with a tax focus. It's why I employ enrolled agents and CPAs, because we have to look at this. But don't overcomplicate it. Try to get enough money in cash that you can go the whole year and not even worry, and then you figure it all out in December. What do you figure out in December? How much am I going to optimize this year's taxes? What am I going to do for my future spending? Any optimization there? And then longer term, should I be converting?
Right. And then, and this usually just to not, you're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to do this every year for the rest of my life. Not necessarily.
Just till about age 70, 73.
Right. The tricky period is where you have choices to make. Once everything is being thrust upon you without a lot of choice, and the thrust is going to be Social Security is flowing out to you, pensions are flowing out to you, annuity if income, if you
required
have any,
minimum distributions.
Is flowing out. Then you got your required minimum. Those are all being forced upon you, and some people find, well, once all that is forced upon me, it covers all my spending, everything.
Unless you're going to optimize your inheritance, and we need to continue to do tax optimization work, usually by then, it's done. And we tell that to people. You usually have to worry about this from now until everything is turned on.
Right. Unless there are some people that it perfectly still makes sense to do conversions above and beyond those RMDs.
Absolutely.
Once RMDs, a lot of people dismiss and say, oh, yeah, once RMDs are on, we don't do conversions. And they just make it like it's some kind of hard and fast rule. There's definitely times when it makes perfect sense to still convert, even in your 70s, when RMDs have turned on. It not always, but it can. I just don't want people to dismiss it out of hand. But the point is, usually by the mid-70s, things have calmed down enough where things are mostly on autopilot. There's not a lot of complexity. Your accounts have been consolidated into just a handful of things that are easily handled. It just isn't all the time. But in your 60s... as you start retirement, as you go through those first years when it is all about choice, nothing is really being thrust upon you. It's choosing where you're going to get money, where you're going to recognize income. That's where you have all this opportunity to make good choices to lessen your overall tax burden. And for a lot of people, taxes are going to be one of the top three expenses in your retirement.
And taxes are the only expense you can prepay. You can't prepay for your medical. You can't prepay your housing. Those are the other two major expenses. But you can prepay your taxes. You have that ability. And when you prepay, you remove tax uncertainty. Taking money out to fund this $75,000 round-the-world cruise I gave in this hypothetical, starting to take it out years before it happens, that's prepaying the taxes on that. And you're going to take that money out and you're going to put it in the bank. Why? Because you're going to spend it in another year or two. You're just trying to prepay the taxes on that. Roth conversions is you voluntarily prepaying taxes. Taxes are your only retirement expense, the only one that you can fully prepay. There is none other that I know of. But if you get the money in a Roth, you have fully prepaid your taxes. The point is, you've got to figure this out. And the unfortunate thing, listener, because we're telling you more concept here than solution, it takes very sophisticated software. We use our retirement analysis software, which gives us that longer term 1040 that we need now until mortality to do those projections. We have very advanced and sophisticated tax preparation software that makes TurboTax look like a child's game to figure out the short-term tax needs. And then we use the spending numbers from the retirement analysis as well to come up with your estimated spending that you need to cover. So you need a lot of data numbers. That's going to be the hard part for you guys to get, I think, is going to be the data numbers. For those of you who want to do this yourself, that's going to be the hottest, I think. Would you agree, Chris, the data?
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts. And we just were talking about income taxes, but there's also kind of side effect, effectively taxes.
IRMA, Social Security taxes, NIT, all these things that we have to take into account. When we're trying to project a conversion, we've got to look at IRMA, taxes to Social Security, taxes to a widow or a widower, taxes ultimately to the children under the new Secure Act. There's so many moving parts. You need very sophisticated software, and that we explained to you guys in our EDU shows not too long ago on our process. Taxes were going to be the thorn in your side, literally and figuratively. They are, everyone fixates Chris on paying them, but the other difficulty with taxes is projecting and estimating them. And it takes very sophisticated software far beyond any free website or even TurboTax's capabilities. TurboTax will do a tax return, but it's not great at doing tax projections now until mortality and showing you how every little move is going to change the taxability of Social Security, for instance. That takes very sophisticated software. So you might have to reluctantly, kicking and screaming, have to hire someone to help you do this. So unfortunately, most CPA firms are not in a position to do this because they're more of a tax preparation and not really a planning firm. But I do know some CPA mm-hmm. firms are getting involved in planning. Look for CPAs who have a hashtag after their name. Or what the hell, not a hashtag. What do you call that? Slash? It's a slash thing. That slash? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it'll say PFS. Personal financial specialist. That's a CPA who is concentrating more on financial planning. They may have the ability to do your taxes and have the software that's going to do these forward-looking projections. Or you can find a financial planning firm like ours. I'm not saying this is a shout-out, you have to hire us, and we have a freeze on taking new clients on right now anyways, and we won't be unfreezing for a few months now. But find a financial planning firm that does have this forward-looking tax capabilities. A lot of planning firms, financial planning firms, Chris, don't do taxes at all.
No, they just kind of gloss over it. Yeah, they admit that there are taxes there. And
they tell you, go talk to your CPA. Right, and right. Your CPA says, I don't know how to do this. I don't have any forward-looking software. Mm-hmm. So look for a CPA / PFS or look for a financial planning firm that, like mine, employs CPAs, but we take a forward-looking tax outlook, not a historical-looking tax preparation outlook. We offer preparation, but it's more as a convenience so people don't have to do it. But our forte is projecting forward, and that's what you need. You need a little bit of tax clarity. That's why we say our process, if you follow it, you will have the clarity, confidence, and comfort. But to get that clarity, you need very advanced software.
Yep. Well, actually, Jim had to take off, so I'm going to handle this third question alone. It's a Social Security question. So this has come in pretty recently, but it's a question that I get generally all the time about Social Security, maybe not phrased like this, but the same topic. So email goes, I'm 74. My wife is 72. We're both in excellent health. According to Live to 100, which is a website that some people use, we've used it occasionally to help people estimate, if you can do such a thing, how what kind of age of mortality they would have based on their health and gender and current age and things like that. But they went to that website, and it told them that they might expect to live to 99. And they continue, Social Security is important to our minimum dignity floor. I read that the Social Security lockbox will run out of money in 2035 with a potential 20 to 25% haircut to our Social Security payments. What do you think, and how would you recommend covering this potential shortcoming? While my name isn't George, I'm originally from Georgia. So thanks for a great podcast. So like I said, I get this all the time. This is something that isn't a secret that is talked about in the media a fair amount, and it's also, even if you look at your Social Security benefit statement, it states it right on the bottom, I believe, of the first page, where it talks about, under current projections, the Social Security, he called it the lockbox, it's the Social Security Trust Fund that has been building up reserves since the early 80s when there was Social Security reform under the Reagan administration. The reform was done at that time in anticipation for exactly what's happening now, which is the baby boomers, the baby boomer wave, if you will, hitting the Social Security system. And they realized that there was going to be a disconnect between the workers paying in and the number of people claiming benefits. As a reminder to everyone, when you contribute to Social Security, it's not going into an account for you. Current workers are paying the benefits for current retirees. It's a wealth transfer system. It's not a savings account. It's not an account that you're putting money in and then taking money back out. when you're receiving money, I wouldn't even, if I were you, I wouldn't consider it your money coming back. Your money's gone. That went to somebody else. You should be thankful, in my opinion, to the people who are currently working. They're the ones paying your Social Security benefits. Nonetheless, that trust fund has been building up over time in anticipation of what we've achieved now here in 2020, which is more money is flowing out than flowing in. In other words, more benefits are being paid than are being received in the form of Social Security taxes being collected by the Social Security Administration. Right now, it's not a problem because they built up this trust fund. It's starting to drain that trust fund, and the estimates, unfortunately, despite all the preparation that was started back in the 80s, the trust fund never got big enough to completely handle the baby boomer wave. So in 2034, roughly, 2035 in that area, it's anticipated that the trust fund will be extinguished. That does not mean Social Security doesn't have money anymore, because every year people, current workers, are paying into the system. What that does mean is there's no excess, so all they can pay out is what's coming in. And if that happens with no other changes to the system, it's anticipated that they will only be able to pay out about 20% of what they have promised. I'm sorry, they will only be able to pay out about 80% of what they promised. That's referencing the comment by this person with a 20 to 25% haircut. So that is possible. Is it likely for someone in their shoes? I don't think so. They're 74 and 72. In 2035, that's 15 years from today. So they're going to be almost 88, 90 at that point. And I would not anticipate in any reasonable universe that they're going to pull the rug out from under 88 and 90 year olds who have no other choice for income but the Social Security that they're receiving. Could other people face a haircut? Absolutely. I think younger individuals could face a haircut. I anticipate worst case scenario that people currently collecting will not be affected, but future beneficiaries will be affected in combination with more taxes being collected. Some solution like that is what I anticipate. But if Washington, D.C. sits on their hands and does absolutely nothing, Social Security, under its current rules, will have to cut benefits by about 20% in 2035. I think that would be political suicide for Congress if they would just sit back and let that happen. So I don't anticipate that happening, but it's going to take us getting closer to that point. This is kind of like the iceberg and the Titanic is heading for it, and the closer the ship gets to the iceberg, the less options there are in avoiding it, and those options are far more drastic. So I wish, wishful thinking here, that Congress had dealt with this a while ago, because if you turn the Titanic soon enough, you don't have to turn the wheel very much to avoid the iceberg. But the closer and closer you get, you're going to have to crank the wheel on that thing, and it may not feel very good to some people. So I unfortunately anticipate this coming down to a few years out from the deadline, if you will, but I anticipate there to be some sort of solution that gets deployed that will hold harmless those in this particular listener's situation at those ages. The government and the programs they have just typically do not work like that. People are usually grandfathered into far less important things than this. So something of this level of importance, I would think that people well into their 70s, 80s, and possibly 90s will likely have nothing at all to worry about as far as a cut goes. Could they have kind of a clandestine cut where they reduce the cost of living adjustment? Yeah, and you could argue that is going to affect a 90-year-old, absolutely. But a 90-year-old doesn't have that much longer to live, so it's not like the cumulative punishment of a less than adequate cost of living adjustment would affect them. It's just not very punitive at that point once you're old enough where you aren't going to experience it for a long period of time. So I think a lot of people are overly worried about this. The people who should be worried about it are not worried enough. The people who should be worrying about it are the people who can change it. And that's because they're the ones with their hands on the wheel of the ship and should be turning it. They should be doing something right now because that would benefit everyone, because the pain that needs to be shared by all participants would be less the earlier they fix something. So we'll see how this evolves. But in this case, I think they're asking, what would I do to cover this shortfall? There's not a lot you can magically do. I mean, if they're going to cut something, you could restrict your spending now in anticipation of that to build up some of your own reserve. But I think the justification for doing that is not very great for someone who's already 74 and 72. So that part's my opinion. If you're really super worried about it, I'd start saving some money off to the side that could step in to replace that 20%. But you're going to be sacrificing things that you can do. If you're able to do that, then you could protect. That's really the only reasonable choice. So thanks, everybody, for listening to another show. If you would like to send in your own questions, do so at our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. It's a contact form on there. And for a while, we weren't getting all the messages sent through that, but we've gotten that fixed. So should be a reliable way to get us your questions. And we'll add them to the pile here. And I guess we'll dive into a few more next week on our next brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.